For Graham.
Good afternoon. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Three bills here today. We're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2386. Richard, if you could give us a quick summary.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2386 prohibits school districts from requiring students to wear, carry, or use any item with a radio frequency identification device if the device is for the purpose of locating or tracking a student or for taking attendance. It also has a notice requirement in the case of a student possessing property with such a kind of identification device in it. It declares an emergency effective 1st of July, 2013.
Okay, we have two state reps to testify on this to start us off. I think. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we hope that there will soon be a member of the Senate here as well. We'll see. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. And we're very pleased to be here to help present this bill. This is a bill that was considered in the House committee and referred to the House floor and passed, I think, with very high numbers. I don't remember exactly what it was.
58.
58 votes. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that. The impetus for this bill, as far as I was concerned, was reading a report of a school district in Texas that had decided that they were going to take attendance and track students using RFID devices that would allow them to monitor students in their buildings. And of course, the thing about these devices is that they can be activated any place. They don't necessarily work just in the building. I was concerned, and apparently the House agreed with me, that this is a significant privacy issue and may put students at risk. Some of the issues that with RFID devices is the problem that it becomes easy then to track students, who they're associating with, where they're spending their time in the school building and other places. We were concerned that it might lead to students to avoid engaging in activities that might actually benefit them, for example, seeking counseling and other kinds of things that would, because their presence in a counselor's office would be documented as part of this tracking system. Another issue that's an important issue when you're dealing with these kind of devices is the ability to track them in an unauthorized way by anybody who can read the device. A student's location could be monitored from a distance by somebody with a purpose other than the purpose intended by the school district. Now, I recognize the industry claims that that isn't the case, but the reality is that there are no devices that emit this kind of information that can't be tracked by somebody who has the knowledge and determination to do it. Relying on these devices for security rather than human observation also creates new security risks that could be problems. Students could be counted as present on campus when their tag is being actually carried by somebody else. They may, in fact, be miles away and doing something that wouldn't be countenanced by their parents or their school district and might be a long way off and a long way over a long period of time before they were noticed. It was noticed that they were missing. So relying on these kinds of devices is dangerous for those reasons as well. What the bill does is prohibits the district from requiring a student to wear this kind of device or carrying an item with a device attached to it if it's used for the purpose of locating or tracking the student or taking attendance. It does not prohibit the use of the devices for tracking equipment. You could attach it to a piece of equipment that it needs to be moved from one classroom to another, for example, so you could track the piece of equipment around the building. It simply would require that you not use it for tracking students. If, in fact, you're going to use the device for tracking property, like a projector or something that might be, or a computer that might be moved from one room to another, or books that a student might check out of the library, then the student would need to be notified that these devices have tracking capabilities attached to them. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes what I wanted to say, at least in direct, and be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm for the record, I'm Lou Frederick, a state representative from District 43 North in Northeast Portland. Representative Barnhart has given some of the technical details. I just wanted to say that this is one of those cases where technology has run out ahead of our tools and policies for making sure that it serves the purposes that are both appropriate and humane. While tracking students may seem attractive at first thought, school students are human beings, and if we don't draw the boundaries regarding their personal autonomy, we will find that threshold harder to protect ourselves. Now, I will admit that my staff has threatened to put a tracking device on me if I forget my phone again, and there's been some question about whether these already tracking students' movements and locations via radio frequency ID is, that's truly 1984 stuff. And Orwell wrote a cautionary tale, not an instruction manual. So we need to be realizing that. The technology currently exists to do this. It's getting more sophisticated very quickly, but that doesn't mean we should use it. The bill provides for legitimate use of this technology to track and monitor property, as Representative Barnhart said, but students are not property. I urge you to approve this bill. And I will end with another note. I had a call to the Sandia Labs many years ago to talk with folks about security, et cetera, and they said that it was a question of getting the mouse trap to try to stop various security issues from taking place. And the person I talked with said the problem we have is that we have a high-tech mouse trap. We will also have high-tech mice. And we need to recognize that that's the case, and how we deal with this is a very different issue. So I think this helps us get ahead of that curve regarding the use of technology. And again, very simply, students are not property. This is a privacy issue, and I think it should be dealt with just that way. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to add one more comment, if I may. This bill, nobody claims that this bill is perfect or that it's anything more than a first attempt. What it does do is that if a school district decided they wanted to use this kind of technology to do something that involves students, they would have to come back and bring a justification, a reason for doing it. What we're trying to do is head off the kinds of things that are already happening in Texas from happening here.
Just to make clear, this isn't being done in Oregon, and as far as I can see, nobody has proposed anything.
That's correct, and this is the time, therefore, to put sideboards in place around these kinds of things.
Can I ask kind of a devil's advocate question? I have a young child in schools, and in the wake of the school shooting at Newton and some of these other things, if the school called me and said, you know, we've got some serious safety concerns here, and one thing that we might do is, you could call it tracking, or if it was, whatever you call it, if it was part of some kind of an emergency procedure that they would put in place, I have to tell you, as a parent, I'd probably want to sign up.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I don't think this bill prevents that.
Mm-mm.
The bill says the school district may not require a student. If the district contacted you as the parent and said, we'd like to do it, mm-hmm. I think you can give permission.
Mm-hmm.
First, Representative Frederick, you're wondering about your lapel button. You see, I don't wear one. So just be, because it may be. Are we talking devices that are similar to what we put on people on probation?
Actually, in some cases, we're talking much smaller than that. We're talking
But basically, they do the same thing, so.
They can.
Yeah.
I'm unaware. I don't know anything about that.
Well, I would suggest treating children in the same manner we treat people that are on supervised probation is maybe a bit too far.
Senator Roblin?
I think this is a good bill, and I just was concerned that you didn't put down, it doesn't prohibit implantation of a device.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, I would note that in the floor note that you, I think you have, it says, among other things, that RFIDs are used in many industries such as manufacturing and agriculture. RFID tags may be implanted into livestock to allow identification of the animal, or attached to a car to track its progress on an assembly line.
I understand that, but you didn't say that they couldn't do it here. I understood that they do it. They do it in pets and all sorts of things. But you're saying here that it's not one of those that you've said you can't do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, I think that the bill read fairly would prevent that from occurring without the permission of the parent.
Right. And they can't use it for these reasons. They could.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator, no.
I think, Senator Roblin, I think you're serious, correct?
Not entirely, but
not entirely.
Because I knew that it would take a parent permission to implant anything. But well, I do worry about those things at times. Yes.
Well, I think the bill is fairly clear, but if you want an amendment to that,
no, I think I'm okay. I can go with the bill because I think since you still couldn't use it, even if you could implant it, I think that'd be okay.
All right. Well, I think it's a great bill.
I do too.
I do too.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Becky Strauss, ACLU.
She's probably.
Mr. Chair, I'm gonna just take a bet here that she likes the bill, but we'll see.
I don't know. Chair Hatch, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU. We are in strong support of this bill and thank the representatives for bringing it forth. They've mentioned most everything, and I've submitted written testimony, so I don't think I need to take your time to explain it. I think that just generally we're getting to a point now in many areas where technology is outpacing our laws. Technology raises all sorts of privacy issues, and location tracking certainly is not unique. Senator Cruz, you mentioned the criminal context, and granted, this is a different area. This is even a different area of law, but it's important to think about when we do mobile tracking. Again, Senator Cruz and Roblin from the Judiciary Committee know this very well. When we do location tracking of suspects, there's a warrant required, and there's a statutory limitations on what context for what crimes persons can be location tracked in real time. And this just seems very consistent with that idea that we need to be thoughtful and careful about when we use location tracking technology. Just one thing to address the security of students issue that Chair Haas that you raised. I think there is a flip side to exploring the use for this for student security because of the risk of security breach. And I think Representative Barnhart mentioned this a little bit, but there is that risk that someone takes hold of the chip and either duplicates it, so then has all the information, or takes hold of it outside of the context of the student. For example, in California, there was a preschool that was using jerseys, put jerseys on the children with RFID tags on them to kind of track. So if the jersey is somehow removed and the jersey is still in school, but the child is kidnapped in this hypothetical, that is not providing us, obviously, with the security that we're looking for, and in many ways provides us with a false sense of security. So I thank you for your consideration. I thank you to the representatives for bringing this forward. And I hope you will move it forward. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair. Becky, I'm assuming, and I should have asked the representative, that a system like this would be relatively easy to hack into. It would have to be. I mean, there's not a system built that can't be hacked, and I would think that this sort of system would be relatively easy to hack into. So the downside, I think, is much greater than the upside.
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, I would agree with you. I don't know about the details of the technology, but again, whenever we're using technology in this way, there's the privacy concern, and then there's also the security concern, the security of the information, and I think that's very pertinent here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Craven, Tech America.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Craven representing Tech America. I feel like a salmon swimming up at Bonneville at the moment, but give it my best shot. Tech America is the nation's largest trade association that represents the technology industry, and out of our thousands some members, I think we do have some who make this technology, and really wanted me just to share some technological answer questions to the best of my ability, which is not terribly deep. First of all, I do want to acknowledge that we did not testify against this bill on the House side. And for that, I apologize. It's not like me. This was the second week of session. I was informing my clients that this bill is before them, before the House body. We're a national trade association. Sometimes it takes a while to poll our members and get consensus. We missed the ball. So I just want to put that on the record. I have had some conversations with the chief sponsor and talked about the bill, so it's not a surprise that I'm up here today. Since we represent people who make equipment, you can appreciate that we're cautious and skeptical against about any state law that would ban the use of a technology outright. When I first started lobbying in 1989, there was a big concern about CRTs, cathode ray tubes, particularly the ones that are used as computer monitors in the old day. I believe there was even a bill that would have, 1987, that would have either put warning labels, health warning labels or something on it. I think Governor Attia even vetoed that bill. That's how far down the road it got. Subsequently, an international research team was assembled up in Canada. They spent a couple of years on the issue and basically told people to stand down, that the allegation that had been made about health concerns were unwarranted, and the issue kind of went away. So the only reason I bring that up is to say that technology is constantly evolving and that we should be use caution when we just outright ban the use of a technology. I'm not arguing that there's never a case to be made, but I would urge you to think about that. In the specific issue, we have a bill before us that bans a technology, radio frequency ID, quote, for the purpose of locating or tracking a student or taking attendance. And the bill doesn't distinguish between the various kinds of RFID technology. The major pots are two. One is called passive tags, which may be in the thing you wave in front of the reader when you go into the basement in the morning with your car. I have one. I don't know why they give them to lobbyists, but we actually have ones that open the side doors here. And so that's an RFID tag. It's passive tag. There's no battery. There's no power source in the tag that you carry. It just, you get real close to a reader and it picks up, the reader sends the signal, sees the card, recognizes it, unlocks the door, opens the gate. There are other more powerful systems called active RFID tags, and that's really what I think the concern of the chief sponsor of the bill is, that do have, the tag itself has a power source, so it's in a sense transmitting and looking for a match with a reader. And those could be, if you spend enough money and bought the high-powered system, could be used to, in real time, in a given day, know that Johnny's out on the playground, or, you know, Susie in English class. But just to say that there is a difference here among the various uses. You could have you could require students to carry an ID card that all it would do, as they walk in the front door of the school in the morning, would log them as present. And you could use that as an attendance. Really, as I understand the school district in Texas that implemented this system and caused a bit of an uproar, was using it mainly to have a stronger auditable ADW for state funding. I mean, that was the purpose. It was not to monitor whether a student was going to the counseling office. It was a way to have a very simple and sort of audit trail way to tell the state, give us our ADW money for our students because we can prove that they attended on a given day. So you could have an RFID tag where a student, all it did was open a door. And so we get into the definition here of whether that would be attendance or tracking, you know, in the words of the law. But the point is there are various different systems in this technology. And this bill says we can't use them for tracking students. It doesn't exactly define what tracking means. I think Representative Barnhart has said being able to monitor student movements through the building during the day. So we'll accept that as what tracking is. And we do appreciate the privacy concerns that have been raised by the chief sponsor, and our industry shares those concerns in this increasingly interconnected world. But I think some of the alarm bells that you just heard about the use of the technology, I guess I would disagree that those sort of out-on-the-edge scenarios are possible or even likely. You've heard that people could, potentially bad people, could scan kids and read their tag. Most of the tags, what the tag transmits to the base reader is a set of ones and zeros. The tag does not send out, I'm Susie, you know, Susie Wilson. It says dot, 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 dit, 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 dit. That's picked up by the reader and then located in a base computer. So the idea that somehow somebody could point a beam at someone and scan their information is probably not technically true. And if it were true, maybe they could scan the information that, wow, that's Susie Wilson. It's not going to have much more than that on the tag. The other issue I'll skip that. So I think, as the chair has mentioned, that we're not aware that this is an issue that is ripe in Oregon. I talked to school boards and talked to the Department of Education. No one has heard that anyone is planning or contemplating this. And one response to that, sure, would be, let's stop it before it happens. I mean, that's a legitimate point of view. Let's not let it ever happen. But I think another way to look at it would be, let's talk about frameworks or guidelines if a school was contemplating using either a low power system, a high power system. What are the kinds of steps they should go to before they just kick this off? In a couple of districts around the country where this has happened, it's my opinion that those districts did a really poor job of explaining the technology, talking to parents, involving the community, you know, asking people whether they wanted their kids to do this or not, and had that kind of local conversation. I think that's an alternative to the bill before you today. If we indeed want to have a bill, that one alternative would be to say, ask the Department of Education to convene a group that would say, we'll set some guidelines, some sideboards, requiring public hearings, maybe even limiting the types of uses to open the door or not open the door, and set up a process that if a local district in Oregon were to contemplate doing this, they would have some sideboards and guidelines about how to do it well at the local level with their own community. So that's my pitch today, to have a slightly different look at it and maybe to clarify some of the technological concerns. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming forward. I think at the beginning what you meant to say was you were a salmon with a radio tag swimming upstream.
I think there are some.
We do have that.
I think we do put
yes,
some
we
tags
do.
In.
We do that.
And they are implanted.
So. Yeah, that's what I are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, would the industry have the same concern if the bill said before a school district can do this, they must get parental approval?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the scheme I presented as an alternative would be more of a global, to have a broader conversation. Certainly, to have a system that did that, I think a district would have to, you know, weigh the pros and cons. If they really want it because they're concerned about being able to find students in an emergency, or they really want it for ADW tracking purposes, they might not want a hodgepodge, opt-in, opt-out. But it's something that people could explore, sure.
What strikes me, I mean, we're sort of doing knee-jerk reaction to this, but it seems like there's some very positives about this. In the instance a couple of years ago where the young student was, we assume, kidnapped out of the school, this would have been something very quickly where we might have been able to locate that student.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer,
kind of a fire or something in the school, right. One of the things that the firefighters want to know real quick is who's there, is there anybody there? Particularly in elementary school, well, actually in any school, this would be, has some very positive aspects to that.
Right, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, just to clarify that, most of the systems out there that I'm aware of are fairly low range. So you're not going to be able to, what was that movie where they're, you know, the helicopters in the sky can just find anybody on Earth at any given moment. Maybe the technology exists now, I'm not sure. But you could verify in or out. You couldn't go find them in the community. You couldn't track them down. You can't put up the helicopter and go find the missing child. But in the case you mentioned, it could possibly be aware that you would know when that child exited that building, which was a key part of that case that the police have wrestled with. So.
That's a good point. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2386. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2689. Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2689A permits public bodies to enter into cooperative agreements with youth job development organizations for the provision of services by youth participants on public resource projects. It specifies assurances that must be contained in the cooperative agreements, and it exempts cooperative agreements from public contracting code.
Okay, if only we could find Representative Phil Barnhart. Oh, there he is. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. I'm here in support of House Bill 2689 today, and I want to simply make a couple of comments about the Northwest Youth Corps in connection with this proposal. I've been aware of this agency in my area. It's actually located physically. Their main office is located in my district. It's in an old school building that they've extensively remodeled. They use it for educational programs. They use it as the home base for their work programs. That are done primarily with young students and youth. And one of the problems that they came up with as they do this work was the discovery that there's no good model for them to make agreements with municipal corporations in Oregon to bid on public works contracts that would allow them to provide services that are within the realm that their young members are capable of performing, from which they can earn a wage and also have a valuable educational experience. This bill is intended to make up for that lack and contains a number of provisions that are designed to set the sideboards within which that could operate and make it much more comfortable for them to do with Oregon cities and other agencies things which they routinely do now with federal agencies such as the Forest Service. And that's the point of the bill, and I'd leave the details to the other people who are planning to testify today.
Okay. Questions for Representative Barnhart? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Let's call Pat Riggs Henson and her team panel. Welcome.
Chairman Hassan, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Jeff Parker. I'm the Executive Director at Northwest Youth Corps, and it's a real honor to be here today to testify in support of House Bill 2689. With me is a student, Hayden Brown, and one of our AmeriCorps members, Julie Bonaduce. I'd like to start our testimony, and we will keep it brief today, with just a little bit of background information about the Northwest Youth Corps and other organizations like Northwest Youth Corps that are doing job training and workforce development for young people in the state of Oregon. Hopefully I can make this technology work. So our core purpose at Northwest Youth Corps is to provide opportunities for youth and young adults to experience success, and we do this through five core values. We focus on education, and here you see a group of students in the classroom and then that same group of students or many of the same students out in the field doing field-based education. we focus on challenge. Most of our programs are difficult, both intellectually challenging, physically challenging, and sometimes a little bit emotionally challenging when we take young people out into the field, a place where they maybe haven't been. It's not in their, it's not something they do every day in their normal routine. We get a lot of conservation work done, but we also do outdoor adventure and introduce young people to our natural heritage. We focus on community. As you can see, there's a couple of different crews here. All of our programs function in a crew-based model, and it's taking young people, putting them in an environment where they have to work as a team. Success or failure depends on their ability to work as a team. Here on the right-hand side of the picture is some of our high school students, two different colors of crew colors, a red and a yellow crew, and then one of our backcountry crews, the orange crew, looking, it looks like they're somewhere in the Siskiyou National Forest. We spend a lot of time focusing on leadership development with the young people that come to us, whether that is how to lead a youth crew on a trail project or whether it is how to persevere and help your teammates get through a long backcountry hiking experience. We want to develop leadership in our young people to put them back into the community better prepared to meet success. A little bit about our history. We started in 1984. We're a private nonprofit. We were based on the Civilian Conservation Corps model. And we're guided by a belief that youth and young adults could come together and achieve really professional project outcomes on our conservation priority conservation projects while developing critical life skills. We started by partnering with the timber products industry. Essentially, the first 4 years of what we did was piled slash in mitigation efforts of post-harvest activities. Over time, we grew, our reputation grew for providing a good product in the field, and we've had sustained growth with the partners that we work with the regions that we work in, and with the capacity of work projects that we do. We have three main program areas, our youth core programs. This is what we're most known for, and that's our residential programs. 5 weeks at a time, young people show up and do an orientation. We take them in the woods for five straight weeks. It's an adventure format. Young people travel all throughout the state. They work on different project types. They get to see amazing parts of our state and Washington or Idaho and Northern California. The work is hard. It's labor-intensive conservation work, but students also earn a credit and a quarter of a high school credit by their participation, and they're also introduced to outdoor recreation opportunities. Our goal there is to give them a sense of teamwork, to develop leadership, and to develop job skills. They leave with a stipend, paid, so they're paid for their work there. They leave with high school credit, and they leave with lifelong friendships. Our second program model is our Outdoor Oregon model. This is a four-year-old model, and it's essentially our residential program without the residential piece. It's a Monday through Friday day crew format. We started this program based on feedback from our legislative delegation. Many people were saying we want local youth working on local projects, and it took us a while to retool what we do, but we started it 4 years ago, and right now we're working in about nine communities in the state of Oregon, mostly up and down the I-5 corridor, but we have one in Coos Bay. We have one in Klamath Falls. It's the same sort of ethic, though. It's the labor-intensive conservation work. It's earning a paycheck. It's the job skills development, and it's the school credit. But what's unique about this program is it's local kids working on local projects. And so we're seeing a development of an ethic of stewardship on their own community resources. Our third program area is our outdoor high school, and that's based in Eugene. It's on our campus in the Laurel Valley. It's an accredited alternative high school. We have freshmen through senior classes. We put together a format that's 50% of the time in the field and 50% of the time in the classroom. It's project-based learning. And what we found is there's a particular type of student, one of them sitting right next to me here, who really blossoms in an environment where they're not stuffed in a classroom of 40 and expected to sit for 7.5 hours a day and listen to somebody talk to them. So it's experiential in nature, and it's up and out of the chairs and getting our hands dirty. Our focus there is to really push young people towards educational pathways, to seek out resource management career opportunities, but to seek out post-secondary academic opportunities. A little bit about the youth that we serve. We do work in a five-state area, and we do have open enrollment. So we have participants come from all over the country. But in the 1,000 young people we served last year, almost 700 of them were from Oregon. And those are from all areas of the state. There's a graphic here I'll show you in a moment where our participants come from. You'll see it's heavily weighted on the west side of the Cascades, but we do try to draw from, you know, equally from all over the state. A heavy influence in Lane County, and that's because some of our programming only happens in Lane County, our outdoor high school, and some of our programs for 7 to 11-year-olds happen at our campus and nowhere else. But you can see we take a nice mix of participants from rural areas, urban areas. We mix them all together. We put them on the same crews. We send them out to get high-priority projects done. And the learning, the value of that is that they're working together with people that they would never cross paths with in their normal routine. This is a three-year look at areas that we've done work projects. So every one of these blue dots is 432 hours of work. Most of the blue dots you would see on are right over our federal public lands, and that's one of the things that House Bill 2689 starts to address, is how do we find increased opportunities with local and municipal agencies, because right now the authority that we have with our federal partners allows us to enter cooperative work agreements. We don't have that same authority with local or municipal agencies. We talk a lot about youth outcomes. That's our focus as an organization. We want to see young people earn that high school diploma. We want to see them be college ready. We want to see them be ready for apprenticeship programs. We want to see them be ready for the workforce. And the biggest thing is we want them to have some knowledge about the career pathway that they want to choose. We have a lot of young people that come to our organization. They have a 5-week experience, a 10-week experience, or a 3-year high school experience, and it really changes the way they see the world and the direction that they want to head in it. So when we think about the outcomes, we're trying to prepare young people to be successful. They're going to determine what success is, but we want to give them the tools to go meet the challenges. Some of the community needs that we focus on. Right now, youth unemployment for 18 to 24-year-olds is almost 20%. Last summer, in 2012, one in four young people in the ages 16 to 19 had a summer job. And now not all four of them wanted a summer job, but 25% is pretty staggering. We're trying to provide jobs today. We put money in young people's pockets, but we're also trying to prepare the workforce of tomorrow. And it's a critical link. If young people don't have that first work experience that's good and rewarding and intriguing, we run the risk of just skipping a generation with that really critical workforce experience. From a community development standpoint, the projects that we do every day are critical restoration projects: trail maintenance, stream restoration, noxious weed eradication. These are things that help improve our lands and waters, and they have a really big economic impact in some of the rural communities that we work in that rely so much on infrastructure for their tourism dollars. What makes us tick is our partnerships. So this graph comes right from our annual report, which you have a hard copy of in front of you. 62% of the revenues that make up our operating expenses come from fee-for-service work projects. The work that we do, the partnerships that we have, and primarily they're with our federal partners, make up 62% of our operating budget. 17% comes from grants and donations, and then we do have some public school contracts and some tuition and fees. But that 62% is what's critical for us to be able to stay in business and keep providing these opportunities for young people. Right now, we have over 17,000 alumni that have participated in our program. Last year, we put $1.4 million in the pockets of young people through the young adult wages and then the student stipends. Our goal is to have an opportunity for every Oregon teen who wants one. Last year, we served 1,000 young people. We had 2,000 applications, so the need is there. As I said, our fee-for-service project partners are what it takes to support the programming. Right now, when we go to most city or county entities, they love what we do. They want to work with us, but we don't have the legal mechanism to do it. They send us down to procurement. We don't have an employer-employee relationship because we have students. We don't have employees. And they say, it would be great to do something with you. We just can't do it because you don't meet the procurement requirements. House Bill 2689 is a technical fix to provide the same authority that we have with our federal partners at the state and local level. Nope, got ahead of myself. So that's what this bill is all about. From my perspective, it's a technical fix, but from my math, it will provide increased opportunities for young Oregonians just for the Northwest Youth Corps. When we look at our Outdoor Oregon program, you know, within 2 years, I could see this providing anywhere from 150 to 200 more opportunities for Oregon youth. I thank you for the opportunity. I'm here to answer questions, or we can have Hayden and Julie testify.
Jeff, Hayden, Julie, did you want to add to Mr. Parker's comments?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman Haas, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Hayden Brown, and I'm a senior at the Northwest Youth Corps Outdoor School. As a student here, I strive every day to complete my schoolwork and to ensure my timely graduation and to become a part of the network of people who helped me get where I am today. Originally, I joined the Northwest Youth Corps to give my summer life some structure as well as to spend as much time as possible in nature. I also thoroughly enjoy pushing myself out of my comfort zone, and there are few better ways for youth in the Northwestern United States to do so than to join a session with NYC. While on session with NYC, it is not uncommon for participants to have life-changing revelations. As a participant, I was no different. I realized on session how incredible the NYC organization truly is. NYC provides a great opportunity for people like me to connect with employers and people of similar life experience to help me with whatever I am going through or whatever I want to do in the future. NYC gives me much more than physical and mental strength, which it certainly does. It also gives me a sense of community, as well as a network of options and possibilities. With these ideals and values I have taken away, I have decided to pursue a future in organic farming and permaculture. Eventually, I would like to go to the University of British Columbia and pursue a future in wildlife preservation and environmental lobbying. For these reasons, and among many other, Northwest Youth Corps is imperative for the future of our youth and conservation in the U.S. It's helped me turn from an aimless teen into a high school graduate with a plan, and not only a plan, but the conviction to make that plan a reality. Thank you, Chairman Haas, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Haas, and members of the committee. My name is Julie Bonaduce, and I work for Northwest Youth Corps as an AmeriCorps staff member at the Outdoor High School. I'm also an alumni of the NYC's Arizona Challenge Program, and I am a graduate of the Outdoor High School as well. I first came into NYC when I was looking for an alternative education experience. I'd always been a good student in high school, gotten good grades, but I was bored out of my mind. I didn't like sitting on my bum in school all day. At NYC, at the Outdoor High School, I flourished. I was encouraged to be active and learn through hands-on experiences. And mind you, I came from a home that wasn't exactly what you call outdoorsy. To this day, my mom's idea of roughing it is getting bad room service. So the idea of camping and doing hard, physical, manual labor was something that was very foreign to me. There were times when I wondered what I got myself into, how I was going to make it through, and I felt like I was in way over my head. But a big part of what I learned at NYC was not just about the work itself, but about work ethic, responsibility, accountability, discipline, and a very real understanding of what it means to be a part of a team and a community. I spent 5 weeks in desert wilderness of Arizona building hiking trails in the Grand Canyon. My peers depended on me. My crew leaders depended on me. And I worked harder than I had ever worked on anything before in my life. While there were times I was frustrated and exhausted, and I did think about quitting, there was a sense of confidence and pride that grew within me just because I was there doing this sort of work even to begin with. And so I stuck with it. And the longer I stuck with it, the more I learned that I loved that out-of-my-comfort-zone feeling. It felt good to be out there doing things and helping out on projects that I would have never imagined I could do. But being out there instilled a hunger in me, a drive, and a sense of ambition that is still very much with me today, a decade later. Since leaving NYC, I've been to college, graduated college, gotten a good job, quit that good job, opened my own business, and been successfully self-employed. When I heard about an opportunity to come back and work for NYC, I jumped at the opportunity and closed my business to come back and share what I learned with the students who are there now. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff, I don't think anybody argues with what an excellent program you have. This bill would help you do more schools, but one of your charts suggested that you do schools already. So, what can you clear that up for me?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, we do three different types of programs. So, the school that we have is based in Eugene. We'd love to see that. We'd love to export that model, but that's not really our focus right now. The limiting factor for us to expand our opportunities for young people is the fee-for-service work projects that we have. And so where we've really noticed the need here is in the Outdoor Oregon program, which is the non-residential Monday through Friday program. The reason that's become a challenge for us is when we work in a residential setting for our federal partners, it's really easy for the Willamette National Forest to say, well, we have 5 weeks of thinning that needs to happen in this really remote location. You guys camp, so you can go there and spend the 5 weeks there. What we notice with our Outdoor Oregon program is we're working in the urban or suburban corridor. We need a meeting place that's local for the population. And so our work projects have to be within a half hour, 45-minute drive from that place. So our federal partners aren't in those locations. And so what we really need to make that program grow and flourish is partnerships with counties, cities, PUDs, utility companies, because that is the public lands that are within that driving distance for us in a Monday through Friday format. Did that answer?
Yeah, so will you be doing more work on actual school grounds, or just it's just the proximity?
Mr. Chair, typically our meeting spot is at a school, but then we go out from there.
You're not going to be mowing lawns at the
no.
school?
Okay. No, and I think it's worth...
Because you'd have to get all new slides, because those slides had mountains and trails and everything.
Right.
It's much more exciting and intriguing than...
Well, it is. For example, we had a crew in Sandy, and you know Sandy is kind of that suburban interface, and so a lot of work. You know, half hour from Sandy, you can get to some pretty remarkable places. A half hour from Eugene, you can get to some pretty remarkable places. But in all reality, you know, the crew that we run in Eugene does a lot of blackberry clearing in public spaces that don't have that mountain backdrop. That's for sure.
Senator Roebling.
Yeah, I guess my question is, because I agree, and I really love the programs, and I love the programs that happen in Coos Bay, and at times it frustrates me because of the fact that you're an education institution as a school, you don't have to meet the labor law, the child labor laws with respect to pay and all this kind of thing, because you're not paying them, basically. They're earning certain different kinds of things. But I guess what I'd ask for the student, the experience about their working with their hands and doing stuff was probably as much as anything the deal that helped bring the other stuff to life. And unless you're in one of your programs, we don't get to do that with kids very much anymore. So was that the part that really brought it all together for you, was the actual getting to do the work? The classroom came second. After a while, the classroom came first. But to begin with, it was the other way around.
Yeah, no, I did the summer session first before I joined the Northwest Youth Corps Outdoor School, and that set me on a path for conservation. And up to that point, that was my freshman year in high school, after my freshman year in high school, and I had failed every class, had about a 0% GPA. I couldn't make it, but I found the Northwest Youth Corps Outdoor School, and that saved me.
And did they let you use power equipment and everything else when you were out there?
No.
Not till later,
We don't use power tools.
That's right.
At the outdoor school, like Jeff had said, we do 50-50, so half the time we're in the field and half the time we're in the class. And on those field weeks, we'll go and do projects normally in town, like sometimes we'll go to Mount Pisgah or something like that, but most of the time we're pretty local, doing blackberry removal or clearing brush or cutting a new trail, something like that.
How does this or does this compare to Job Corps?
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Cruz, so Job Corps is a federal program.
Right.
And so the difference with Job Corps is typically a Job Corps position is a year-long position. It's very, very specifically vocationally driven. So each Job Corps campus has a specific vocation or technical piece that they focus on depending on the location. We work, one, with a younger population.
Okay.
We're focused more on basic job skills, work ethic, teamwork, perseverance. You know, we have a very close relationship with the Job Corps campuses because many of our graduates are uniquely qualified to go to Job Corps because they've already, you know, proven themselves at those basic things that, you know, a lot of the private employers we talk to struggle finding candidates that have that.
So you've had some of your kids end up at Wolf Creek then, for example, probably.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Senator Bart.
I was going to say, I'm very familiar with the program. It's incredibly unique program and works very, very well for the right young people, and provides a good summer experience in that.
Oh, yeah.
It's wonderful. And Senator Cruz, actually, the original NYC program, the Job Corps, were all started about the same time as part of the Great Society program. So I think Oregon used to have, I think we still have 3 Job Corps centers in Oregon.
Yeah.
I have one in my district.
And mine, too.
And one in yours?
Yes.
And one up north.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike Straub, Barry Chambliss, Scott Winkles.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mary Chambliss, and I participated in the NYC program in 1986, so I'm one of the original members. I was lucky enough that I found out about the program just right before I went on summer break that year at my high school, and I applied for the program, and I instantly got in. So I was one of the lucky few that had an opening here at NYC. During the time I was at NYC, as they said, it was a lot of hard work. We were out there working really hard all day in the field, and then going back and living in a tent, cooking on a campfire, and taking care of everything that needed to happen in the camp. So it was a real eye-opening experience. But during the course of this experience, I learned a lot. I learned, first of all, how to work as part of a team. I learned how to be outside and enjoy being outside regardless of what the weather was like. Part of learning that was not only being an active participant, but looking around and seeing other teenagers having that same experience at the same time and enjoying it together. There is nothing more important to a teenager than other experiences with other teenagers that will make a bigger impact on them than almost anything else we provide for them. So it was a very successful first session for me. I enjoyed it so much that when I got home, I almost immediately left home signing up for the second session this summer. And again, at the time the program was small enough, I could do that. After that, I finished high school. I went to college. When I was in college, I used the training I learned in NYC to apply to work with the Forest Service as a firefighter, and that experience helped me being accepted as a firefighter as a summer program when I was in college to help earn a better living, but also to continue to learn about the outdoors and some of the job potentials out there. Years later, I worked for 11 years with teenagers after college, and found a lot about teenagers and what worked and what didn't work with teenagers, and now I have 2 of my own at home. During that time, I found as much as I would like to as a parent to have them have the same values as I do, it can be a challenge at times, and as much as I try to draw them into the outdoors, sometimes they get stuck indoors with their video games and their computers and their TVs, and it's harder for them, I think, now today to spend as much time outside as I did growing up as a kid. And that's something I want to continue to have them learn to appreciate and enjoy. Now I work not only as an at-home parent, but also as a forest property owner, and that has also changed my perspective on the way I view today's young population. As a property owner, there's a lot of new concerns that are facing us. Here in Oregon, we love the large green spaces that are available to us. Publicly and privately, we have some of the most beautiful land I imagine here in the United States. I'm a little biased that way. But being able to maintain that land and keeping it beautiful and healthy takes a lot of work. We're at a time right now where a lot of the work is being done by crews that are aging because they're having a hard time finding younger people that are interested in doing outdoor physical work here in our Oregon climate, which a lot of times is pretty rainy and muddy. So I'm running into difficulties as a property owner, sometimes having crews available to do some of the work that we need to do to keep our forests healthy. That's a concern for me. Another thing that's becoming a concern for me as a property owner, I'm also going to trainings with other property owners, and succession planning is an additional concern that we're facing. Right now in Oregon, 3.5 million acres of Oregon prime forest is owned by private landowners. Of these, more than half of them are 65 and older. Many of these landowners do not have somebody in their family in the younger generations coming up that are interested in going outside and doing the work that's involved in being a property owner. We're at a point in time where we need to be engaging kids. We need to be getting them up and moving and outdoors. And you can't turn on a TV or read a newspaper without reading about concerns about kids being overweight and lethargic and spending all their time doing screen time. Right now, NYC is providing an opportunity. We have teenagers that are advocating for themselves and asking for the ability to leave technology behind and go out and have these work experiences. And it's a shame that half of them are being denied these opportunities because there are not openings in the program. So as somebody that was lucky enough not only have one experience at NYC, but to have two, I would ask you to also help provide more experiences for these teenagers that are asking for that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mike Straub. I'm Mary's father. And after Mary had such a good experience with Northwest Youth Corps, four of our other children also went through it. And I just couldn't say enough of how it built up their self-confidence and their appreciation of work. We thought we'd done pretty good raising them on a farm, but what they got from Northwest Youth Corps was amazing. When they went on after their experience in Northwest Youth Corps and applied for other jobs and got a recommendation from the Northwest Youth Corps, assuming they deserved it, it just opened doors for them. I think I'm also on the board of NYC now, partly because of how positive I am about what they're doing, and it's real important that this bill get approved so we have more opportunities to give these kids this experience to build up the self-confidence in their work skills. Because when we were young, you could go out and pick beans or do a lot of this manual stuff, and the opportunities aren't there now. So it's kind of got to come through the public agencies, and the doors have got to be open there. So I hope this bill can be approved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and we really like this bill. I don't think it was when the contract code was put in place in its current form, it was envisioned that the type of activity that you heard about today would be prohibited. We're left with with the letter of the law, and the letter of the law simply doesn't really allow us to form these sorts of partnerships with this group. It seems ironic to us that we can have kids who make a mistake and get sentenced to community service do work in our parks, but we can't take motivated kids who want to learn and put them to work doing something educational and meaningful that they would like to do and that we need done. And so with that, I urge the passage of this legislation.
Thank you. Questions for our panel? All right. Thank you very much for
your
testimony. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2689 and open up a work session on House Bill 2689. Senator Knope.
Chair Hass, I move House Bill 2689A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 2689 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection? Seeing none, the measure passes. House Bill 2689A goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Beyer, your name is posted on this bill.
You're happy to
carry it.
Would
you like to carry this? Okay. All right. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2979. Richard, if you could give us a summary.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2979 establishes a work group to study how to establish common course numbering system for lower division undergraduate courses in the Oregon public colleges and universities. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Great. We have Representative Dembro here to fill us in.
I think Rep. Johnson was going to be here, but okay. Mike Selig from the OEIB is here. Can he come up?
Absolutely,
as well?
Mike.
Good
Okay, thank you, Chair Haas, members of the Education Committee. I'm Michael Dembro, representing House District 45. That's Northeast Portland out to Park Rose. This is really a very simple bill that extends the work that we're all trying to do to make transfer easier and to help students complete their college education more quickly as a result. But back in the 90s, there was an effort in the state to look at our lower division courses and try to bring their numbers into alignment so that, you know, if you took writing 121 at this college or at that university or, you know, at that other college, you would essentially be getting the same course, and students would be able to transfer as a result much more easily. And we made a lot of progress. There were, you know, work groups of college faculty, university faculty, and we were able to be very largely successful at getting to common course numbering. But, you know, over the years, things kind of drift. And, you know, in some cases, at that time, you know, most of our lower division courses were three-credit courses. Now, in some areas, those have become four-credit at one institution, you know, three-credit at another. Three-term sequences have become two-term sequences. There's been a lot of creativity, often for good reasons, but ultimately creating another set of roadblocks and obstacles to students. So there were a few of us who were, back in December, we were at a conference for an organization called Complete College America. They had their annual meeting in New Orleans, and we had Representative Johnson and I from the Higher Ed Committee, Mike Sealing from OEIB, people from OUS, from Community College, CCWD, were in New Orleans, and most of what we did there I really cannot speak about, but one of the positive things, that productive things that came out of it was we were looking at Common Course numbering as a way to get us to a higher degree of college completion. That was one of the recommendations that came out of the that conference. So Representative Johnson and I decided, well, why don't we charge the heck with looking at where we are as far as Common Course numbering. A lot of people have a sense, that, as I mentioned before, that we've drifted away. Let's do an assessment, see where we are, and if appropriate, the heck, make recommendations to the legislature to, you know, go back to another effort at getting us to Common Course numbering. The heck is very interested in taking on this work. I just spoke with them about an hour ago. It's exactly what the heck is supposed to be doing in terms of getting us to greater alignment between the community colleges, the universities, and when appropriate, the independent colleges and universities as well. So that's what this bill does, I think it passed off the House floor unanimously or pretty close to it. Most people see it as a good idea, and I would urge you to support it. And I think Mike can talk about it from the perspective of, you know, that P20 continuum, because, you know, I didn't mention it, it also, now that we're moving more aggressively into the area of dual credit, it's really important that we're dealing with common courses as students are trying to transfer their credits from the high school to the university. And I will say one other thing. We just, on our side, we had a hearing yesterday. Senator Knope was there with people from OSU Cascades and the Central Oregon Community College about the partnerships that they're doing. As you may know, students will start their college career at the community college and then finish at OSU Cascades. It's a great relationship. And we were talking about, you know, as OSU Cascades is moving towards offering its own lower division courses, how important it will be to be able to have those courses be cross-listed, community college, university, and for that it's really going to be important that they have those identical numbers and be covering the same material. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Okay, Mike. There was one excused.
Siri?
One excused. 59-1. You were right.
I tried.
I know.
Thank you, Chair, and the committee. OEIB's goal is to reach 40-40-20 by 2025, and our mission in order
to... Start off with your ID.
I apologize. Michael Selig, Strategic Initiatives Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board. OEIB's goal is to reach 40-40-20 by 2025. In order to do this, we recognize we have to redesign an education system along the P20 continuum that is ultimately responsive to the needs of our students and our families. And part of doing this is recognizing where there are existing inefficiencies in the system and rebuilding those components anew. A lot of times these are cornerstones of our educational system, rebuilding those anew so that they're prepared to enact this 21st century educational system that we're hoping to see generate 40-40-20. So common course numbering is one of the places we've identified that we think there's an inefficiency here, and we think we could really clear the way and opening pathways for a lot of our students. There's three real areas that we think this is going to affect students. The first is in building a seamless transition from secondary to post-secondary education. We know that along the P20 continuum, one of the places where a lot of students fall off track is in that inter-institutional transition from secondary to post-secondary education. We know that remediation is oftentimes a cause of this, as well as just the complexities of getting enrolled in college, getting registered, getting your courses on time. One solution to this has been dual credit, and we've seen great results throughout the state, primarily in places like Hermiston and Pendleton through a program like the Eastern Promise. What these programs do is they build articulated pathways from the universities and community colleges down into the high schools so students can earn dual credit. Now, building those pathways, while it may sound a little easy on the surface, it's actually quite a bit of legwork. It's time-intensive. It's labor-intensive. And the more course numbers, the more institutions you're dealing with, the more high schools, the more complicated that becomes. So we've recognized that rather than having every school or institution invent their own process, simplifying this process by having common course numbering would go a tremendous distance in this respect. The second point here is simplifying the registration process and easing the burden on counselors who are already overwhelmed by increased course loads. We all know that reduction in force notices have been going out to not only teachers but counselors. One of the primary jobs a counselor does is help seniors get ready for college, make sure they've got the required courses. Part of that time they spend is just decoding the alphabet soup of course catalogs and deciding if they're going to go to one college or another, which courses, and as Representative Dembro has said, sometimes it's a two-course sequence, sometimes it's a three-course sequence. We recognize that a lot of these conversations could be severely reduced in time, if not eliminated altogether, by just having a common lingua franca for these courses. The last piece here is by providing students the opportunity to move to various institutions to find pathways that work for their needs. One of the cornerstones of building a response P20 system is building it in a way that helps kids who are moving, who are going through different regions, who may decide they want to change majors, making sure that they have pathways that they can find and easily change courses. The achievement gap that we've been hearing about for the last 10 or 15 years now has recently come to be redefined as an opportunity gap. And we recognize that some of the opportunities could simply be in being able to change institutions without getting credits thrown out or having to retake a course or having a course recognized as being valid. We also recognize that education is becoming regional. Our workforce is becoming regional. We have students moving in between states and all up and down the West Coast now. So we recognize there's potential for greater communication between Oregon and states like Washington and California as well.
I see the need to want to align all of these stars, and especially with our increased emphasis on dual credits. I guess my only question would be, do we really need a law to get the commission to convene a work group?
Mm-hmm. Senator Haass, I'm not sure that we actually need a law, but what putting this into statute does is it confirms our, you know, our belief in, you know, the goal of Common Core numbering, you know, which, you know, as I said, the legislature had committed to back in the 90s. Are we still committed to that goal? I believe that, you know, we should be, and this would send that message. You know, to be honest, the HEC has gotten used to our sending them work, which they have done to great, you know, I think with great dispatch, especially given the short timelines we've given them.
Welcome, Rep. Johnson.
What bill are we on?
we're still working on the sales tax bill.
Yeah. And we appreciate your support.
I was a little starry-eyed. I just watched John Rakowitz exhibit his lobbying mastery in front of Paul Holvey, so I'm still, I can't believe you did it, but yes.
Wow. Well, we went through the bill on what the work group would do, and I don't think anybody argues with it. I guess one of the issues, and I think Michael made it, Representative Demereaux made a pretty good case for whether or not we even needed a law, but it is a directive, I guess, to HEC.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that the concept of Mark Johnson, State Rep for House District 52, the concept for Common Core numbering is something that perhaps it's already been shared, but we were at a Complete College America convention or meeting in New Orleans in December, and it became pretty apparent that there are other states that have gone much farther than Oregon has to this point, and they had a chance to talk about the advantages for them and their higher ed system and how it really has streamlined the process of going through, you know, i.e. knowing if I get this course at this level, it counts the same thing all the way through. It's equally recognized for value throughout the system, and that really is what's intended here. I know there's some work to get there. It's going to take some time for a little give and take within the system itself and so forth. There always is, but I think putting together a work group on this is a good way to go to really flesh out the concept, get all the stakeholders together so that we're not imposing something on someone that there's going to be burdensome or troublesome for them. But I think we can get there, and I think it'll really help us tremendously in our quest towards 40-40-20.
Question, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, now that Representative Johnson's here, because in Representative Demereaux's testimony, he said something that kind of piqued my curiosity when he said that most of what they did in New Orleans you couldn't talk about, and I bet Representative Demereaux, you said that, you know, the most of what you
I couldn't talk about. However, Representative,
that's why we assumed that he could. That's why we thought he could.
Well, having been to New Orleans. I just thought that was an interesting comment, that most of what you did you couldn't talk about. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's really exciting to have a university higher ed professor sitting in front of me, and so I can ask this question as a lowly high school teacher of the past. How about your autonomy of the individual professors for their individual courses, and how do you get past that? Because that, to me, has been the biggest frustration that I have noted in my high school teaching career, trying to figure that stuff out. So. You here. So I can.
Thank you, Senator Roblin, through Senator Haass. Actually, I'm not currently a university professor. I'm a community college professor.
That's right. Higher ed.
And actually, to that end, you know, I teach at a college with multiple campuses, and I can tell you that the faculty at each campus believe they should be designing the courses for their campus.
Yep.
And so this is a struggle even within a college that we've been dealing with. And bringing, and I can tell you from my own experience, it's been easier to get consensus among colleges and universities around the state than campuses within my own college. So this is, it is an ongoing struggle, but it's an important one.
And
those conversations actually have been very productive, I have to say. I was part of that process in the 90s, and it was tough. But it was good because it caused people to have to come together and think about, okay, so what are we trying to achieve with this course? What do students need? And it really helps to know that, you know, my students are getting the same thing as students elsewhere and are going to have just as good a chance of being successful as those students.
And to your question, Chair Haass, I think this is one of the reasons why it needs to be a law. I just... If they, HEC can do it, and I think they could, but I think if everybody's pushing at the same plane and saying, okay, professors, we appreciate your individual knowledge and your individual stuff, but we as a state have an investment that we're making in that, and we expect certain things, and we need you all to work together to get there. So I think that's another reason why it's so important to have a bill as well as HEC.
Yeah. Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2979. Let's open up a work session on House Bill 2979.
Chair asks, I move House Bill 2979 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 2979 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, say that the sponsors of the bill still wouldn't disclose what they didn't want to talk about from when they were in New Orleans. Neither one. So there's a big black hole there that we don't know what it is. So.
I noticed that, too. Further discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2979 passes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Roblin, we're up to you.
Fine. I'd be happy.
Okay. That clears our agenda for the day. With no further business before us, we are adjourned.